This is The Conversation. It's episode 153. Back with Nate O'Thompson, part two. You guys know why you're here. And if you just happen to stumble across this episode in your feed, I would recommend checking out part one, episode 152, if I were you. We will get to the resumption of that conversation in just a second. I just wanted to mention a couple of quick things before we do that are both Nate O'Thompson related. One of them is that part one, which came out last weekend, has done pretty well in terms of hits, in terms of downloads, considering that is, in my opinion, among the most thought-provoking, if not best, episodes that have aired on this show. The numbers are not quite matching that. So because of that, I would like to ask you, being that you are here for part two, to do me a favor, do us a favor, and find one friend, at least one friend or colleague, and introduce them to the episode, get them to download it as well. That way we can build up those numbers. There's a recent episode that's doing better than this one, let's put it that way. And I think this one's more important. So if you can help with that, it would be greatly appreciated. The other thing, lighter thing, that I wanted to mention that using the lens of Nato's book, Seeing Power, you can look at it with a different angle. And that is, in the Sunday Times, last Sunday, on the front page, below the fold, but on the front page, there was a piece on a sale of a Ross Bleckner painting to Alec Baldwin through Mary Boone. And you can easily find it online if you want all the juicy details. But the gist of it is that Alec Baldwin had been given a Ross Bleckner painting that was slightly different than the one he fell in love with from the invitation that he was carrying around with him. It was very similar, but it was a secondary flower painting. And there have been, you know, lawyers involved and whatnot. And he insists that he is entitled to the original that he paid $190,000 for. And so all that to say that this story is not news, as you probably know. And so the question is, why is it on the front page of the Sunday New York Times? And I think the answer, there are a couple of answers. One is that, well, it's Sunday, you know, it's a lighter day in a sense, even though there's still things going on in the world over the weekend, you know, it's a little bit of a lighter respite amongst the more hard-hitting stuff on the front page. So that's one way to look at it. Another, though, is that who are the readers of the New York Times and you know, what do they want? And that's kind of something that Nato talks about in his book. You know, this is the cultural elite who get especially the Sunday Times. And I'm not among them, by the way, but I do read it. And, you know, so they're pandering, if you want to put it bluntly, to that audience. What is ultimately a form of arts and leisure titillation is also a form of pandering to not only their readers, but also, you know, the art world that either indirectly or directly supports the existence of the Times. Something along those lines. You can read more about it in Nato's book. Very good. I hope you are ready for the continuation. I will back up a bit in the conversation so you get to hear the question again, and then we'll jump right in. Stay tuned, please, for the back end where we're going to introduce a new shout-out forum and a thank you as well. So stay tuned for that. Thank you very much for being here. I'll talk to you on the back end. You wrote, in activist circles, the term radicalized embodies the condition of becoming provoked by all of the groups and artists I've described. We often find the term used in a phrase like, I became radicalized during the Occupy Wall Street protests. It describes the moment when people who normally considered the regular channels of governmental reform sufficient see the fabric of social life tear before their eyes. It is a moment when they suddenly become aware of the power of collective action and witness a stark contrast between the rhetoric of capitalist democracy and its nascent mechanisms of discipline and control. And you go on to cite the RNC conventions of 04 and 08, Occupy Wall Street, Black Lives Matter. So the question, having stated all that, is you alluded to it, what was your radicalized moment?
Yeah.
Do you have one?
Well, what I'm trying to think through it. Well, certainly I have some obvious ones. I'm trying to think of the key early ones because, I mean, certainly the biggest one for me was during the all-globalization movement was the protest that happened in Seattle in November of 1999.
Mm-hmm.
And only because it's like the beginning of the internet in a way,
mm-hmm.
like the social. It's mm-hmm. like the early, it's like Web 1.0. And that's when indie media arrived and these protests started spreading across the planet in a way that was mind-blowing to me.
Mm-hmm.
That like something I was involved in. I didn't go to Seattle, but my friends all went, and I mm-hmm. felt part of the old globalization movement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But suddenly I saw this giant community emerge out of nowhere. And it just felt like we actually had power. You know, like there was something real. It wasn't an abstraction.
Right.
And then the other thing I'd say, too, is that just to say, living in the co-ops in Berkeley, which is student-run housing, so mm-hmm. You collectivized your money, mm-hmm. we all cook together and stuff. And it's an incredible, incredible system based on what's called the Rochdale Principles. But I would say what I really appreciated about that was that something about having your own governance over money and the way you lived your life on a collective level was totally mind-blowing for me in terms of power, right? In terms of we often, you know, many people just live their lives paying rent to someone they don't know and working for someone they don't like, and every form of agency is to completely extract it from them.
Right.
And that's not to point the finger at them. That's just the condition of power we live in. But when you have spaces where you have your own power,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
it's a total other way of living on the planet.
Right.
And when you see that, I feel like in your heart, you do not want that to ever go away.
And living in that collective, was that sort of where the seed was planted for that worldview?
I don't know. I mean, I also grew up on a commune, so I don't – in Holland. So I have – it goes deep, that. But it certainly inspired a lot of it. And I've seen that, too, in my own experiences. I mean, in this city of New York, you know, it's a gigantic city. And then there's this one little organization called 16 Beaver that's been just meeting weekly every Monday for, I don't know, 14 years. And it was a lot of Whitney Independent Study Program graduates who started it, and they all kind of cruised through there. But it had a huge, huge effect on this city,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it was just an informal space. And when I was working in Chicago with this group, Temporary Services, and then they had a space called Temporary Services, and then it mutated into a space called Mess Hall, it was profoundly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Not that anyone in the arts like were like, that's the place where everything happens. They didn't even acknowledge it.
Right.
But so many incredible artists moved through these spaces, and the ideas they produced were so interesting and thoughtful, and they were totally resistant to the art world, deeply hostile to it,
mm-hmm.
but very invested in art and politics.
Mm-hmm.
And these spaces, which are like typically run by three or four people, you know,
mm-hmm.
have huge ramifications. And I've seen that over the years. You know, the older you get, you realize just a few, you know, little scenes run by three people in a little room for 5 years can really change an art scene, strangely
right.
enough.
Right.
And we've all paid witness to it. But, you know, when you're younger, you think that this stuff doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, I'm doing this thing, but no one cares. But it really, historically, those are things that change a lot of things.
Towards the beginning, when you mentioned recognizing your ability to introduce fellow isolated antisocial artists, you know, and that was sort of the birth of being a curator. I wonder if, in light of the things you were just saying, if you introduce activists and more sort of traditional artists or vice versa.
Oh, definitely. I mean,
yeah.
you know, it's been a long-standing mission of mine
mm-hmm.
to get the traditional left
mm-hmm.
to know that there's an art left.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, and I mean this in the most simple ways. For example, I just in terms of a mark of success, I have a little list of things I want to accomplish. One was So we did the summit at the Venice Biennale, and that was not the thing I wanted to accomplish, was to put it out there. But I was very glad to get the invitation from Okuyama. That was cool. But what was amazing was that Men brought Democracy Now! To report on it.
Oh, you got cut off for a second. Did you say Judy Goodman?
Amy Goodman,
from
the show
right.
Democracy Now!
Right.
Spent 3 days reporting live from the Creative Times Summit.
Wow.
And I've often felt like the kind of traditional left or the activist left has no knowledge of the global left contemporary art world.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They may all quote Marx, but they don't even recognize each other's existences.
Right.
So it was really wonderful to bring Amy Goodman there, who, you know, ate it up and was like interviewing Emily Jassir about what it's like to be an artist from Palestine. And then, you know, interviewing Maryam Ghani about her relationship to Afghanistan and her kind of role in culturally documenting the film industry there. And it was amazing to see that this kind of pairing of communities that you would think would be together but weren't had some ramifications. And so certainly that has been one of the different kind of things that it's an ongoing effort, because I think the art world can, you know, and I mean this, and I'm talking about like the arty political left can still be somewhat self-ghettoizing.
That's what I was going to ask you. What exactly is the art left? I mean, and I assume you mentioned a couple of names. I assume Tanya Bruguera would be part of that cohort as well, right? So, they're on one hand, they're in the quote unquote art world, but they're sort of the really political end of it, as opposed to the social activists who are just completely outside of the art world?
It tends to be that way. There are some hybrid characters who put their feet in each world. I mean, I would say people like the Yes Men have got their feet in both worlds to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
But they're more few and far between, the ones that have their feet in both worlds. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those bridge builders, often the artists. And, you know, and it's okay. I mean, everyone's busy, right? So you can only focus on so much.
Yeah, that's
right. And people got to get paid,
you know?
So, like, an artist that's doing left stuff tends to, like, be trying to hustle to get their kind of art thing going or get their adjunct teaching thing going or whatever they got to get going.
Right.
And I would also say, too, you know, unlike – so Tanya Bruguera is a very successful artist in so much as she's been in Documenta. She does these big museum shows. So she isn't certainly, I would say, the epitome of the art left, the left wing artist,
because
certainly the ones I think of often are the ones who are not making any money on it, but really believe in it still, and often have to get adjunct teaching jobs or something. You know, they got their hustle on the side to keep food on the table while they pursue this thing. And I would say that those artists also are, over the years, they get much more ambivalent about commercial success or even any kind of museological success, and find other avenues more in the kind of communities that they're operating in. Particularly, I think of like Chicago, where a lot of artists I know are, you know, have stopped worrying about the art world a long time ago, but still are very invested in the conversation around arts and politics and social justice.
Right. One of the things that you talk about a lot in the book is cultural capital. And so I wanted to get to this particular passage where you say that there's a particular set of rules that govern social relations in each of these spaces, forms of gaining power and demonstrating prominence, turns of phrase, gestures to make and not to make. Master of these rules is the acquisition of cultural capital. In a career, we are able to maneuver not only by doing what is considered good work, but also because we know the right jokes to tell, the right people to spend time with, the right clothes to wear. We understand particular cultural references, and we are in cahoots with a certain common sensibility that motivates our actions. We gain a sense of how the game is played, and we play it well for the purpose of gaining more power. Social capital, in turn, represents the estimated financial benefits associated with someone's power inside a specific milieu, as well as the benefits one acquires from simply operating within a particular field. Each field, of course, has its own sense of what constitutes cultural capital. For artists, it means listing other artists and influential curators they may know, name dropping, as we alluded to earlier. So we can kind of dig into that, but maybe before we do, I wanted to ask you, what was it initially like for you, obviously having sort of been incubated to some extent in the art world, as it were, But getting figuring out how to navigate the mastery of these career roles, is it something that if you look back, you can kind of see it evolving, you know? Because you, I think, I want to just preface one more thing about what I just read, and that is that on one hand, I can imagine a lot of people listening to this going, yeah, so, you know, that's completely obvious. But for me, you're voicing it, you're writing it, is actually pretty revolutionary, because this is one of the things about the art world, among many others, that is swept under the rug or left in the back room. And so actually giving voice to this reality is extremely important, I think. So all that said, what was
I appreciate that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I agree with you completely.
Great.
In fact, in naming it, I feel like you suddenly have to address it.
Right.
Right. So that, for example, you know, I mean, on a simple level, you know, you go to these art conferences sometimes, and everyone's famous.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But people don't consider fame a form. You know, they think of like fame as just an unsaid thing. But you're like, I don't understand. You put together a show, but everyone's famous.
Yeah.
Like you don't, but you don't. It's not in the text. That you know, the curator never writes. And by the way, everyone in here is famous.
Right. Right.
And yet, it is so there.
But as a viewer, you know, experiencing a show like that, a lot of artists are going, you know, you couldn't have one lesser known artist in the show.
Right. Well, and I think the other part of that too is that, I mean, honestly, I think social capital, culture capital is particularly important in the arts, in so much as, unlike, it's not like a raw material like oil, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like oil costs this much per barrel.
Right.
In a lot of the power of art, particularly in rests on an artist's ability to navigate these social spheres.
Right?
Who, you know, in terms of interpreting what you're doing, in terms of making reference to this so that it seems like you're doing this, and who can read it and who cannot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that in a stylistics way, is certainly involved in the legibility of art. And also I would say that, and I also think it's an unsaid important thing to say about human relationships, because social capital can be very destructive you know, it's very difficult because people live in a very competitive world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they're, you know, particularly for artists, they're trying to get ahead. Not all artists are trying to get ahead, but I don't mean it's in a cruel way. I mean, people are just trying to make a living.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, for example, you got an art scene where no one, you know, everyone comes out of undergrad, and they're all friends, and they start an art space, right? And it's all fine, and no one's getting paid. It's all great. And then let's say one of them gets a museum show, and then one of them starts showing around. Suddenly they've got all the social capital.
Right.
And that becomes something you have to navigate suddenly.
Right.
You know? Or let's say you're in Black Lives Matter. It's a movement, right? And it's just like, we're all in this movement together. But suddenly, two of the members are on the front of Time magazine.
Right.
And they're getting flown all around. Or the rest of everybody's sitting around like, hey, why are you getting that? I'm not getting that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a dynamic that's worth addressing. Because it plays on our sense of self and social relationships. But it's also, it's a complicated thing, and I should say that it is all pulled from a sociologist named Pierre Bourdieu,
mm-hmm.
from France,
mm-hmm.
Who really introduced these terms in a profound way. And he used it as a way to talk about the reason why, to talk about poverty and race,
mm-hmm.
the fact
mm-hmm.
that it isn't just education or wealth that limits people's ability to move through classes, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that it's also social codes that, you know, people be like, I'm not racist. I just seem to find white people more funny. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Or like, I just get along with people that I get along with who happen to come from my entire same socioeconomic background.
Right.
You know, like golf guys, they like to get along with guys that play golf. They're not racist. They just like golf and telling weird private school jokes that are really annoying. You know what I mean?
Have you ever been on an art golf sojourn?
Sounds like fun to me.
Okay, no, good. Okay, so you're free.
But in terms of my own personal, yes, but the personal thing too. You know,
yes.
I grew up broke as hell, and I've been very, I was always anxiety ridden about rich people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't understand what makes them tick. I'm not from it,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I also was educated in public schools, and I have deep anxiety about all these really smart New Yorker kids that, like, all went to these private schools and came from really fancy families and
mm-hmm.
stuff, you know? And I still have all that anxiety. But just to say, like, it's taken a lot of time. I think everyone in life, you know, it's trying to understand how to maneuver through different social circles is a bit of a ongoing life lesson. And and also for the art world, that seems so obscure. I mean, when I worked at Mass MoCA and then I came to New York for Creative Time, I was terrified
mm-hmm.
of this place.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw myself at some wealthy cocktail party not knowing what the hell to say.
Right. See, what's interesting to me is in light of your learning of this through the sociology of Bourdieu at some point, and I don't know how long ago that was, but if you became cognizant of that process at this time when you came to Creative Time and you were terrified, it seems like your head would explode, you know, because you're like, on one hand, you're facing the situation. I guess the question is, would it empower you and make you understand what was going on and therefore be able to face it? Or would it just make you so self-conscious that you would kind of, your head would kind of explode?
Yeah. I guess, you know, don't learn this stuff in your 20s.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you can approach this stuff with a much more healthy confidence now than you could then.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because I think it is terrifying, particularly when you realize, like, I mean, I think the wonderful strength, this is a very Nietzschean thing, but,
mm-hmm.
you know, he appreciated that power was completely blind.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, like, people with a lot of privilege, to use the word privilege, don't really understand social capital, right?
Mm-hmm.
They just think the world seems to work out for them.
Right, right.
But people that don't have it are very aware of it.
Right, right, right.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, you can tell someone, like, they'll be like, they're referencing these things I don't understand, and they don't even understand that I don't understand it. You know what I mean?
Right, yes. I think you're just giving people a lot of flashbacks with that description.
But, like, you know, the ruling part of the world is just so oblivious.
Right.
That they live in a social capital bubble.
Right. I could see you.
And I know that because, like, and you know, like when I was in junior high school and all the rich kids would hang out, they had no idea that other people didn't grow up like them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they sensed it, but they didn't really understand what that meant.
Right.
You know?
Right. Yeah. I could see you coming into the company of these smart and rich New Yorkers, as you essentially described them, and having this history of, you know, CalArts in the glory days with the naked swimming pool and the, you know, the anarchist collective and so on, you know, and that they would be charmed like crazy by that stuff, you know. But I guess that's only part of the story, because the other part is that maybe they're making a lot of references that are going over your head.
No, I mean, at this point, it's you know, I'm not so worried about it today.
Sure, I'm talking about, you know, 15
back in
years
the day.
Ago.
Well, of course, yeah. You know, but I think the on a different level, though, you know, it's like they might be charmed. So there's a certain part that's, like, charming, right?
Right.
But let's say they'd want to get down to start talking, like, let's go make some money together.
Right.
They're not going to talk to me.
Right.
You know what I mean? Or, like, when they think of, like, and this is, you know, just to say, social capital works in so many profound ways like this, right? Like, why is it that the directors of big museums are predominantly men?
Yeah.
Well, the answer is that wealthy people feel comfortable, like, that their misogyny
right.
is embedded in the way they feel comfortable.
Right.
They're like, because I feel more confident giving money to men.
Sure.
So it's like this catch 22.
Right.
Which is like the goal of the museum director is to raise money. But the rich people want to give money to a guy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that isn't entirely true. Certainly women are breaking into that, and that's good.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the social capital function of this world is a big part of why the dynamics play out the way they do.
Yeah. Perfect segue, Nato, to the nonprofit worlds that you write about.
Oh, good.
Yes. I parenthetically describe this as the economic math of nonprofits. From time to time, almost every nonprofit organizes a gala that caters to an extremely wealthy class of donor in the hopes of getting these donors to purchase tables. Private donors are also key, and some of a nonprofit's programming is usually supported by large foundations. And some exhibitions are supported by the commercial reps of a particular artist, such as galleries or collectors. Each of these carries with it its own set of values, assumptions, and biases, and one can tell a lot about how an organization gets its support by the kind of programming it does. And it continues a little bit late, 10 pages later. The rise of the nonprofit industrial complex has its own shortcomings. Because nonprofits depend on the whims of the wealthy for their well-being, and increasingly, private funding, as opposed to state or federal money, is how nonprofits survive. There is a natural inertia toward their values and tastes. A board at a nonprofit might tell the director what art or projects to take on, but the effect is generally softer. A director's understandable appeasement of the general aesthetics of the wealthy gnaws away at a nonprofit. Not to mention that nonprofits, particularly nonprofit directors, spend so much of their time raising money that it's very difficult to focus on any other trajectory. Left to its own internal logic, a nonprofit raises money for the purpose of raising money, which is a sentence to end all sentences, more or less. There's a whole other paragraph on nonprofit museums' mission statement, which we can maybe get to in a second, but I wanted to leave it at that for now and maybe add by saying it seems, I just want to put this out there as kind of a big proclamation, that the sense that I got in reading your book, Seeing Power, and your description of the organizations that you've been through and now being with Creative Time is that you're very familiar with the challenges of this scenario of the nonprofit and, you know, and donors and whatnot. But somehow Creative Time, that the very subtle implication is that Creative Time maybe is operating with a little bit less of that cliche. I don't know. That was my sense.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's so funny. You read all that, and you could easily get so cynical, you know, or depressed.
Right. Absolutely.
And especially because, you know, I think it's all the more depressing because so many people want to do good things in the world, and nonprofits seem to be the place to try that stuff out.
Right.
So to have this kind of cynical logic hovering over your head might be somewhat depressing.
Right.
That said, you know, I think in the arts it is helpful, you know, for me as someone that has insights into this to put that out there, because that soft approach I mentioned, which is, I don't think it's the case, although certainly some places do work like that where literally the board is like, we need to show, we need another Warhol show, or more like, we need a Richter show, or we need a Cindy Sherman show, or something like that, you know. There are places that do that. But I think the other effects of this, of course, is that a lot of art institutions are run by people that collect art.
Right.
And their understanding of art is predominantly driven by their own purchasing of art.
Right.
And of collecting. And that frame of reference will have its own implications in what a director can put in front of them as art.
Right.
Because, of course, they'll be like, what is that? Or they'll, you know, you show, like, temporary services, and they'll be like, you know, like, they're like, they're not at Art Basel, man. You're like, what are we talking about here? And, you know, if they can't name drop the artist, like, if they go to Art Basel, Miami, and they say, hey, we're working with temporary services, and someone goes, oh, then they're like, oh, it doesn't even feel fancy anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You know Temporary Services in Nato Thompson's book?
Yeah, and they're like, yeah, it just doesn't quite have the glamour.
Oh, boy.
but I think you that those things, yeah, you know, and those dynamics are very much at work. And honestly, it takes a very strong director to manage all that, you know, because it is a lot of psychological burden. It's a lot of personalities. And I don't want to paint such a broad stroke to say all board members are the same, because I've, in my experience, it's radically different out there. You know, there's certainly people who are wealthy that also understand that there's a complex art world out there, you know?
Yeah.
There are people like that, but there's also other forces. And I would say I've certainly been, and I don't want to turn this into a naming institution, but certainly I think all of us can say we've walked into some places and you just feel like the decisions are made by a very regressive logic and the curators are more at the whim of those powers.
Right. So what is the situation at Creative Time as far as both, you know, generally fundraising and having the agenda set?
Well, I would say this, you know, without, you know, I have to give Ann Pasternak a lot of credit on that, in so much as her, I mean, she benefits greatly from having grown the board herself and the organization over her. She's not here anymore, but she was here for about 20 years. And she turned from an organization of 3 people into an organization of 25. And so in that growth, she's been a real manager of the vision in so much as the board really deferred to her a lot. You know what I mean? That said, I'd also say that we, Creative Time, benefits greatly on operating in an ecosystem where board members also are probably part of other boards.
Right.
You know, so like you may be at Creative Time, but you're also at the Whitney. Or that we're not their sole project. And so they can, we're kind of often the pet project that does the crazy stuff.
Right.
And I think in some ways having the freedom to be the pet project has allowed us to push for things that weren't necessarily on the straight and narrow radar that have actually managed to have some success. And certainly when you show that, you know, you can do these things that aren't cookie cutter but still work, you gain more trust. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you can be like, hey, remember that time we showed that artist that you didn't know of and then the New York Times put it on its front page? You know, and like you can, you know, success certainly helps in building a certain kind of reliability or respect in terms of those relationships. So I think that those things are, those things can be navigated slowly but surely over time. And I also think, you know, it, when we started doing the Creative Time Summit or putting more of an art and social justice tinge to what we were doing, I think that, you know, for a long time that was considered not sexy.
Right.
But, and I think it still isn't totally sexy, but I think it's also, you can appeal to different parts. I think you just have to be somewhat Machiavellian in how you get that on top of the agenda as well.
Right. And to what extent is your job involved fundraising, or is it more on a, you know, sort of covert or just part of the process kind of thing?
It's increasingly more what I do, but when I say increasingly more, I've somehow been gifted an ability to not have to do too much of it over the years.
Right.
And I mean, I certainly, you know, help with like grants and meet with foundations and talk to people about what we're working on. But like, I don't actually go and, you know, some curators literally go on like boat trips with people or go spend, you know, like fundraising is what they do.
Right.
You know, like curators at MoMA, I imagine, or Art Institute of Chicago or the Met probably spend 60%, 70% of their time just having lunch with old ladies.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that's like what politicians do too. You know, it's fundraise. So that's certainly not my, not what I do a lot of.
Right.
I do some more. And I'm kind of excited to understand how that works more. But it hasn't been something I've done a lot of.
Right. And I imagine that the kind of people on your board are more progressive and, you know, and open to, you know, like the summit and those kinds of missions.
Well, yeah, I mean,
they have to be.
And, you know, it's complex. Yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah,
they are.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, getting back to the nonprofit part of your book, because this kind of segues into one of the other missions, which is activism, in this particular section. This is the middle of the book. You write, every nonprofit museum's mission statement contains bold claims about serving the public good. These claims are no longer challenged as most of the critical political art community engages in internecine battles in impoverished niche microeconomies. But they could be. As someone who worked in a museum, I know that even the slightest provocation demanding accountability would send ripples across the museum boards. Power is not static, and institutions are vulnerable to the powers of argumentation and public opinion. Artists should take advantage of this. And this goes back to my mention of Occupy Museums. When Occupy Museums took the hallowed halls of MoMA, they were making a claim on what constituted art. But the Occupy Museums was short-lived, the protest occurred, and the group moved its focus to another institution. Reclaiming an infrastructure requires more than poking holes. It calls for a longer-term approach equipped with humility and patience. One can start one's own small part of an infrastructure, which can produce new forms of meaning over a sustained period. So there you're talking about, at the end, what you referred to earlier, which is basically starting your own institution or your own infrastructure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I do, you know, just to say, I like a dual strategy, which is also to kind of challenge the big machines, because they are certainly powerful things. And, you know, you can look at someone like the Guerrilla Girls, right?
Right.
Who really took a feminist agenda and just called out the crazy lack of women representation in the big museums. And I think they were very effective, you know, in terms of waking people up to that.
Right.
But it was so funny. I was just reading the New York Times today, and they've got this incredible article about all these think tanks that are actually think tanks that have relationships with commercial entities and use their supposed objective studies to legitimate private interests. Right? So you had a guy, I can't quote this correctly, but it's something like someone from the Brookings Institute that was literally a lobbyist for a giant developer in San Francisco and using these academic papers to bolster the argument for this guy's private land use, right? Well, I was to go to the kind of conversation, right? I was like, well, these kind of think tanks, I would imagine, have a mission statement that would state something to the effect of objectivity. And in that, they are deeply vulnerable, right? Because their lack of objectivity, if they do not actually demonstrate objectivity, then they are they've lost their entire point of being in the world. You know what I mean? Because then you would just call them a lobbyist organization.
Right.
And this simultaneously, I think, with artistic institutions like museums, you know, I think everyone will say, you know, if you say challenge someone and say, hey, are you for equal rights? They'll say, of course. Like, everyone's for equal rights. They'll say things like that. And a lot of mission statements hint at this kind of language. But if you challenge it on it, you know, around race or class or social capital, for that matter, they're vulnerable because a lot of this stuff is deeply indefensible.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And they rely a lot on public perception.
Right.
You know, they are, and I think it's always helpful, just on a more strategic activist level, to go after people that don't have a battle plan or are not used to being gone after, you know, rather than, I mean, like, that's why I was like, activists, the last place you want to go after is City Hall.
Yeah.
Because they're so used to it.
Right.
You know, they know exactly what, they make the call. They're like, let's go to Plan 4 or whatever.
Right.
But, like, if you went after the Brookings Institute, they've got, I guarantee you, that place has no plan for you.
Mm-hmm.
Their PR person will totally fuck things up. They'll put out some crazy press release. They'll overreact. They'll probably send in the cops. Like, just strategically. And I think museums, I think with Occupy, for example, with the Gulf Labor thing, I think Guggenheim was totally ill-equipped to deal with that pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, there's these crazy stories where they overreached and, like, they revoked the visiting rights to the Emirates by Andrew Ross, a professor at NYU, and several artists. And then that went in the New York Times, and then the New York Times reporter that reported on the whole thing, it turned out that someone from the Emirates had put a private detective on them, and so then that became a story in the New York, like it never ended, like the news cycle just never ended because they just did not know how to deal with this public scrutiny.
Right. Well, I don't know if this is a good time to bring in a sort of the confusion of social capital, but hopefully it's a relatively good segue. You write around the middle of the book again, it is difficult for us not to believe that things that possess social capital can be anything other than important, but often that's exactly what they are. How many times have artists whose work has received no interest been legitimated by a museum or gallery show? Some people, by the way, call that museum validation, which has led in quick succession to an outburst of collective admiration for that work. Many are so blind to their own adoration for power and importance that they simply trust social capital blindly. They rush toward gestures that are gaining recognition without critically assessing the forces that push forward toward this legitimacy. And later you write, for example, an artist can dismiss the work of a market-friendly artist like Koons while simultaneously gaining social capital with many curators who don't like his work. There is another kind of confusion associated with social capital, the question of intentionality. While we intuitively understand that people need to network and hustle, we no longer know if people are doing things to produce meaning or to produce more social capital, which leads to a paranoia of intentions in a culture as skeptical of bad intentions and as depending on earnest meaning as ours. This is all especially troublesome.
Yeah. And I'm particularly, I think, just to say, the background of that is only my own understanding of the kind of critical left community in the art world, per se, who knows how to navigate those channels very deftly while still hating the art world, but still managing to get in, like, Documenta every 5 years, and the Venice Biennial, and having a lot, what you would consider quite a lot of success.
Right.
And I think don't ever cop to their own ability to navigate power. Because just by saying you're not into the art world doesn't mean you're still not navigating it. And to put it out there on a transparent level myself, clearly I do that. You know, clearly I know how to navigate it, or I wouldn't be where I am.
Right. So how do you navigate it, NATO?
But I think a lot of people are like that. And I don't think it's the finger point. But it's more to kind of just kind of say, like, it's okay to be doing these things. It's weird when we're not more transparent about that kind of stuff.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. So these artists, these left artists that are participating in these international biennials are essentially biting the hand that's feeding them and getting away with it.
Yeah, or like, it's like, and there's other games that are being played. It's a complex world, was what I mean to say, too. It's not like there's just one art world,
Right.
And while you may not get your bread and butter from, like, the commercial art market, you may be, a faculty member at a place that's charging kids tuition up the wazoo.
Right.
I guess it's just, there's a lot of games being played, and it's not a problem that people have to play them. The saying, don't hate the player, hate the game.
Right.
But I think it's weird when people don't cop to their own, our mutual need to somehow navigate these fields.
Right.
That's all. And I also think it's and to go to another thing too, you got someone like, not to quote like the book Commodify Your Dissent by Thomas Frank or his other book Conquest of Cool. These both books came out in the mid-90s, very influential for me. But he was talking about the idea that, of course, being against the man, advertising strategy, influenced by the 60s, that like kind of rebel culture became the language of corporate culture, right? And in some ways, that's very much in the air, where you're like, even Coca-Cola will have an advertisement where people are like in their cubicle, and then they drink a Coke, and they're like, screw this, I'm not working, I'm going to go party,
Right.
Or you have Mac computers, where they have their ads of like, hey, I'm the hip, cool guy, and this is PC, and he's the businessman.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And these kind of embarrassing dualities of like, that somehow power is over there and we're over here.
Right.
While not obviously implicating us within those relationships as well.
Yeah, going back to the complication of, you know, conflict or purity, which is an interesting topic that we could get to. But you write that the quest for money can be hugely consequential. I've seen artists diminish the intensity of their political work as they become increasingly aware of what the market wants, ambiguity. And by the way, just to give listeners more of a context, you talk a lot towards the beginning about didactic art and ambiguous art and the pros and cons of each. So magazines, they know, are more likely to devote attention to them when their critics can assert the presence of such qualities as subtlety, sophistication of meaning and form, and ambiguity, the clarion call of their raison d'etre. But enough of this witch hunt. It is a preoccupation of ours to sniff out the secret capitalists. But as I've said, this finger-pointing simply perpetuates the dynamic. Critique, that favorite word of the left, has become the shovel with which we both assault and build. With every critical blow, not only do we tear down someone else's power, but also buttress our own. Critique is often not much more than a strategy of using someone else's inertia to perpetuate oneself forward. This form is quite common and has long been part of the avant-garde tradition, but it's not useful to critique blindly. After all, one does not get much social capital out of critiquing something that itself has no social capital. And I'll just say one sort of anecdotal thing about this. The spirit of that reminds me of a lot of quotes from really sort of provocative speaking type people, and the people that come to mind are the Italian curators, Massimiliano
Gianni,
and who's the other guy?
Would it be? I'll think of it.
Yeah,
bear with me. Francesco Bonomi.
Francesco Bonomi. Yes, thank you.
Yeah.
That when the quotes that they say are they really kind of like prick up your ears and you're like, whoa, I feel like it's right in the wheelhouse of what you're talking about. You know, they are critiquing to use someone else's inertia to perpetuate themselves forward.
Well, you know, certainly one of the things that brought, you know, one of the unsaid things I'll just say that I was speaking to too is that a lot of my friends that are critics, I mean, and oh gosh, am I dissing them? People spend a lot of time hating on. For a while in the 90s, people spent a lot of time talking about why Nicolas Borio was so terrible, right? Who was this curator who came up with the term relational aesthetics.
Mm.
And then in the more like last 6 or 8 years, all the left-wing people spend a lot of time talking about why Claire Bishop is so wrong, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it just seemed like such a bizarre thing to you see people spending so much time on what's so wrong.
Right.
And you think, what's your fascination with Claire Bishop? Like, why do you spend so much time on someone who, let's face it, isn't speaking to your concerns? Like, why not spend someone who is much more on the same page with you? But my gut was because they weren't recognized by the mainstream art world, right?
Yep.
And that in some ways, to be in conversation with someone that's at the center of the art world, because of course Claire Bishop is, you know, writing for Art Forum and is in a lot of conferences, right? But also to some degree touches upon socially engaged art. In some ways, by critiquing Claire Bishop, critics are able to still be in conversation with the mainstream art world.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I see those maneuvers a lot where I'm like, it's just that I'm skeptical that the people are not copping to their own desire to somehow still be in the mainstream conversation.
Right.
You know, and that if someone critiqued this obscure person on a blog that's a graduate student who has an incredibly great argument, it just wouldn't get any traction because no one would care.
You're reminding me of a podcast that I did a few episodes ago with a critic and writer and teacher named William J. Simmons, who talked about one of the first things I asked him about is, aren't all the people that you're writing about part of the canon? And he said, yeah, well, I'll admit that's true. And essentially he said, you know, I need to write about these people because if I write about people nobody cares about, I can't do that. You know, and I said, well, I guess that makes sense because right now you're going to write about these people who are already known to sort of build up your platform. And then when your platform is fully built up, you can start then to write about people nobody knows about and you can switch the dynamic. So... I don't know.
It is a bit of a slip. I hear you. It is a bit of a slippery logic, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because of course. Because I mean, you know, let's all face it. The canon can be so exhausting. Does it drive you so crazy when you go to museums and you're like, oh, they have this Clifford still?
Right.
Oh, they've got that Rothko.
Right.
Oh, you know, like it's the same people over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And you're just like, enough of this.
Yeah.
And that's, then, like, people go to museums, and they're like, oh, look, there's that Warhol. Like, oh, look, you know, like, what are we doing? I don't know. Anyways, that go-to on the canon is so crazy like that. And, of course, I also know, man, like, museums are desperate to stay in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So they need these reference points of, like, even with, you know, with contemporary art, although now I'm going to start ranting, but, like, the fun thing about contemporary art right now is it's increasingly hard to know who's important.
Mm, mm-hmm.
It's really splintering apart. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you just have this like deep confusion in art institutions where they're like, I don't, is that important? Is that famous? I don't even know. Is that, you know, so I don't know.
So,
the list of people in America that people actually think is famous is shrinking fast.
Or to put it another way, the pluralism is reaching sort of a critical mass where it really is getting close to impossible to, you know. I don't know, but it depends on the context, doesn't it?
But I love that. But just to say, I love it. I'm so pro to go to your pluralism statement.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
The pluralism is reaching a critical mass, and it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and it wasn't that many years ago that, for example, if you were in the Whitney Biennial, that was a big deal.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But that's not the case anymore. And, like, it's like the people are not sure, like, where is the important place to do things? It's unclear. And that decentering, I think, and often, and I really do believe it's two forces. It's also the internationalization of the art world,
mm-hmm.
like just the kind of global dynamics that have been ushering in kind of in a more urgent pace in the last 25 years. But also, I would say, the internet has been a huge destabilizer.
Right.
Because... you know, the art magazines just don't have the same cachet that they once did.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that because my last conversation, we were talking about Art Forum. And, you know, despite the truth in what you just said, Art Forum still has this huge concentration of power in its print advertising, you know, at least in a big segment of the art world. You know, people... flip through that magazine. And maybe, you know, again, to go back to the pluralism thing, maybe that's just, quote unquote, the market part of the art world. But, you know, a lot of people who participate in the art world, that's what they, you know, that's their thing. They get the magazine, they flip through it, they flip through those ads, and then those ads of artists become on the radar. I mean, the conversation was around whether this is Lauren Marinaro, who is a director at Feuer Messler Gallery, they... are to advertise for their artists, you know, and I just, you know, and I was questioning, you know, and she said, well, you know, if it's somebody nobody's really familiar with, it doesn't really make any sense. It's more like the Gagosians of the world where the money to do that is totally non-issue.
Well, and I would say the other thing too, which is, I totally agree with that. I think like, for example, Art Forum holds a huge sway in the art buying circuits.
Mm-hmm.
But... and I've talked to a lot of people about this, and
mm-hmm.
they were like, you know, I've never had the kind of the place where the critical conversation is going so removed from the commercial art world.
Right.
Like, and it needs, you know, this is not the era of minimalism where the conversation is Robert Morris and everyone's buying Robert Morris.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, in my world, and certainly I live in my own particular universe of it, but the places where the conversation's at is not in the art fairs. And in fact, it's not in a lot of the galleries, you know?
Yeah.
And so I feel like you feel this split that's very confusing for people. And I love it. I love it. And I can see it too, because like like I said, you go to the art fairs and you're just like, what? It's like you live in another universe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know where that's going to go. I do think, Lord, I don't know anything about the market, but I'll tell you one thing. When the thing that historically grounds things is where the conversation, let's make it a question. If what makes things historically relevant has something to do with where the conversation is at, then I would say the art market is a gigantic bubble.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You heard it here first.
Because I just don't think that that's, you know, like in 20 years' time, if people are like, who are the most important artists of our time?
Right.
I don't think sales will reflect that.
I can't help but wonder, in terms of potentially bridging the gap of the art market / art forum and the critical discussion, whether when you have the Creative Time Summit in October, if Art Forum, somebody from Art Forum will be covering it and writing about it.
They did. They've done it once. They, you know, it's tricky, too, because it's a repeating event.
Right.
And so it's hard for them to kind of come back to it.
Right.
And to also be fair to Art Forum, they do have interesting stuff in there, just to say. I think it's okay. I'm more saying, like, that they used to be the place, and it isn't the place any longer.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
There's a lot of places that are the place.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, you know, and they've shown up at times, but certainly it's not – it's also not as critical for us to – I like when the magazines come, but we don't have to have the magazines come either.
Right. Right.
Because there's so many other places to have a conversation now.
Right.
That's amazing, you know, because also, like, social media is sort of like press.
Hmm. Well, it kind of depends on how many Instagram followers you have, doesn't it?
Yeah. But you got some people, you know, like, for example, one of our presenters at the summit, Sheila P. Bright, has been following Black Lives Matter. She has now, like, 87,000 followers.
Wow.
And you get these, like, I don't know. You know, you can easily go down the K-hole of social media pontification. But just to go to the kind of decentering of the art, of the kind of where the narrative at, it has deeply done that. And it's been useful for us, too, because, like, for example, with our public art projects, right? Like, people start posting and Instagramming things, and suddenly, even if no magazines reported at all,
right,
it's way out there.
Yeah,
it wasn't that long ago that that wasn't possible.
Mm. Right,
like you had to have a reporter there.
Right. Yeah, I mean, as a curator yourself, to what extent do you feel a need, on a professional level, to keep up with the critical articles? Or just, you know, art articles on any venue. I mean, is it an as needed basis?
I think it's important. Just on a professional level, I feel obliged to know where things are going, like where people are at. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like what's going on. So I do read stuff and check out things. And also, I also check out things I don't really have an interest in just to be knowledgeable of what's happening. And I'm open minded. You know, I go through Chelsea and check out the shows all the time.
Oh, good.
It's fun and I like
okay.
it. Yeah, yeah.
So you really have...
I'm not
have,
like one of these people... Yeah. I'm not one of these people that are like so down on the art world they don't go
right.
to anything. I love going to stuff.
Do you want to spend just the last couple of few minutes talking briefly about the summit coming up? I mean, what kind of things people can expect? Do you want to sort of elevator pitch it a little
sure.
bit?
Yeah. So I'll elevator pitch a few things if you don't mind.
Sure.
So... we have our Creative Time Summit's happening in D.C.
Right.
And it was intentionally, of course, in D.C. during the election period.
Mm.
And something that was very much on our minds when we were thinking about it was, you know, during the election period, people get really into the election.
And they get into politics, unlike the other years, too.
Yeah. But there's something that I've always found somewhat unsettling about elections, which is you just feel like the great range of political discourse tends to be one of these lesser evil kind of moments. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That the richness and space of what is possible for the future tends to be reduced down to, like, as it is, like Hillary or Trump. And, of course, everyone's like – and then it just turns into, like, why we hate Trump. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So rather than, like, go on towards that, like Democrats and Republicans. It's more of a thinking of the opportunity to talk about, like, what do we want our future to look like, and particularly in light of things like Black Lives Matter growing. And also, you know, I'm also very interested in the kind of outcomes of what was the Occupy Wall Street movement. It's like, what the question is, and I think it's also in some ways hinted at with the Bernie Sanders campaign, which is like, what would it mean for resistance movements to actually gain power? That's the kind of question that's on the table.
Right.
Rather than just resist power, but also start putting things out there and like having, you know, do people want to get into government? Are, you know, like what would it mean to gain power? And so that's the kind of operating question that we're coming at it with. And the dates are October 14th, 15th, and 16th. So we have a really great lineup, including Carrie Mae Weems, Hank Willis Thomas, Thomas Frank, the writer I mentioned before, who's also a DC columnist for various magazines and newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Ian MacKay, who was a member
awesome.
Of the band Minor Threat, and then a member
Fugazi.
Of the band Fugazi,
mm-hmm.
and who is one of my heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to talk about DIY,
right.
making it yourself, he is certainly someone to speak to that.
Right.
Then we have also Hansel Rick Obrist will be speaking,
mm-hmm.
which is phenomenal because it's also the 100th anniversary of Dada.
Mm.
And I felt like if you think about the time period that Dada came into being in its disgust of World War I and its kind of rejection of the entire political system, it feels germane to the historical mood we are in today.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and I also want an opportunity to kind of have some weird art stuff that isn't always just so instrumental to go to the ambiguous.
Right.
So we have the art collective Gelatin. We've got this incredible film director named Arthur Jaffa, who...
Arthur Jaffa, the Made in L.A. participant, who was my favorite Made in L.A. artist, by the way, who had, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but his inclusion was not necessarily to be included as artwork, collages from binders that he had been collecting over the years.
Oh my God, those are amazing. I've
yes,
seen them.
Yes, they are.
He's incredible.
Yeah, that's great that you're having him. I heard he's very smart.
Yeah. Oh yeah, super smart.
Right.
He's a badass.
Right.
So it's going to be a really, really great thing. And then we have also have a lot, we're working also with Provisions Library, which is this incredible cultural organization in D.C. for our third day of roundtables, working with local activists. So I'm really excited about that. I'm also working with the artist Pedro Reyes right now with Creative Time.
Mm-hmm.
And we are getting underway a haunted house of political nightmares that'll be open in October in the Brooklyn Army Terminal.
Awesome.
So those are exciting things on the docket. And my next book actually comes out in January.
Oh, my goodness. What is it?
It's called Culture as Weapon, Art and Marketing in the Age of Total Communication.
Okay.
And it's so just to say, it's almost the flip side of the Seeing Power book,
mm-hmm.
which is, this time it's not art made by artists, but more how the tools of art are being used by very powerful forces, from
right.
retail chains to ad execs to political strategists to the U.S. military. So it was a fun little adventure.
Wow. And you've already written it, or are you still finishing it?
Oh, it's done. I'm just final edits right now.
Wow. That's awesome. Will you come back on when you chop it around?
Oh, my God, I would totally do that, and I've really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, me too.
I really appreciate your insightful kind of gleaning, and the discourse has been totally great.
Fantastic, Nato. Yeah, you have been awesome as well. I think listeners can get a lot out of this, so thank you so much.
No problem. Yeah, absolutely.
And we're out. Thank you so much again to Nato. Again, I can't imagine having a more thought-provoking provider of information than Nato Thompson has. And I will indeed, you know, when that book becomes available, I will go get in touch with him again. It could be a while before we hook up, because it was a while in the running for this one. So, but I'm glad to have had him. You can certainly keep the emails coming. I appreciate all the ones that I've gotten with support for this conversation. Thank you to all of you. I also want to thank Joshua Nathanson, a Los Angeles artist, for his generous donation to the show. Thank you, Joshua. And we're starting a new grassrootsy shout-out forum here on the podcast, which I invite you to participate in. It's social media shout-outs. So the first one today is all Instagram, and they are Mandy Maxwell is Instagram handle at Mandy at large, M-A-N-D-Y at large. Xander Lassen, that's Xander with a Z, Lassen, L-A-S-S-E-N, his handle is Xander Lassen, at Xander Lassen. And then we have Catherine Copeland, that's at Catherine, C-A-T-H-E-R-I-N-E, dot Copeland, C-O-P-E-L-A-N-D. So check out those folks on Instagram, if you would, be so kind. And if you are interested in getting a social media shout-out, shoot us an email and we will talk. All right. So thank you so much for listening to Nato Thompson, and would love to hear your feedback on the episode. Again, from last week, you may have heard that we are in the infant stages of starting another podcast that is going to be called something along the lines of How I Get By: Stories from the Gig Economy, something like that. We're still honing that title a bit, but that's the gist of it. It's about conversation, short conversations with people and how they're getting by, you know, and it can be a whole range of demographic, but that is the gist of it. So if you know somebody or you think you would be a great guest for that, get in touch and let us know. All right. Thank you so much again for being here. I will talk to you next week. Ciao for now.